Well, hi, welcome to the Christian Contrast, where we talk about how walking with Jesus leads us to live differently than those in the world around us. And very special guest today, Kurt Bauma, who's a member of our church. And also, Kurt, because this will relate to what we're going to talk about today, can you just share what you do for a living?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm an OBGYN doctor and worked for over 20 years for Kaiser, and now I'm at Loma Linda University doing a combination of pelvic reconstructive surgery and gynecology and a little bit of labor and delivery call. So altogether, I think it's almost 27, 28 years of OBGYN work.
Yeah. And so the reason why that's pertinent to what we're going to talk about today is because in this episode, we are delving into the tumultuous waters of Christians and birth control. And you and I have been talking about the possibility of doing an episode on this for a while. And it's tricky because where we're going to end up sort of landing at the end is there's a lot of things to talk about without a lot of hard and fast black and white rules that we're going to delve out on this. You know, some denominations and famously Catholicism sort of has more stringent lane lines with the whole subject of birth control. The balance that we're looking at is, on the one hand, somebody could say, don't even talk about this. It will easily lead to legalism because you'll just say, this is okay, this is not okay. The other danger of this is that if we don't have this conversation, Christians can make decisions without having thought through both the biblical and also the medical implications of different decisions that we make. And so with that said, I would just love, maybe you could share a little bit, what is your hope of what we can accomplish and what we can pass along through talking about this subject?
Yeah, I know. Since we started talking about it and thinking through it, my thoughts have wandered all over the place. But I think primarily the hope is for the church and for young couples that are seeking guidance in how to address fertility and contraception, and to answer any questions about how it works or what are options and what does the Bible have to say about it. I like the idea of walking through what we know. Like what we know scientifically, these are how these things work scientifically, without going too far into the theoretical, and then putting that with what Scripture has to say about it and how it guides us so that we can put the two together to make wise decisions. I think even for my own life, so much of it was taking for granted that these things were acceptable and okay without understanding exactly how they worked, and sort of walking through that and the challenges of, oh, wait a minute, affected me. So hopefully we can reach others in the church to have that moment, and maybe before they even get married and have kids or newlyweds, and to help guide them as much as we can with that decision process.
Yeah, and I think that's well said. It's not a perfect parallel, but I think if somebody was a believer in Jesus, and when it came to like entertainment decisions, what music you listen to, what movies you watch and stuff like that, their grid was, that is utterly separate from anything the Bible talks about. What I watch, what I listen to, it has nothing to do. Like the Bible sort of has no guidance on that. We would want to say, okay, we're not going to give you the list of 100 rules, like, you know, no movies that, you know, are R-rated, you know, whatever. We wouldn't come up with that, but we would say, hey, we feel like God has something to say about this. We feel like there are issues that you should be taking into consideration in making these decisions. And I think it's similar in this way, where I think for a lot of believers, you know, many of us might start with the idea of saying, hey, we believe that abortion is wrong. We believe that abortion is taking the life of a child wrongly. So that's off the table. So it obviously, not all Christians agree on that, but we're going to kind of start with, all right, we think that that should be a place that we start. We're starting with that as sort of an already taken for granted idea. You know, there's other podcast episodes where you can delve into that. But for that, we're starting with saying, all right, maybe Christians are going in and saying, well, abortion is off the table, but just never thinking through either the form of birth control and what are some of the implications of that, or just even the heart behind how we approach this subject, which is another issue. So one of the reasons I'm really glad to be doing this with you, and for people who are like, why are these two guys talking about birth control? Mm-hmm. Big part of it is because this is an area where you have some level of expertise and understanding that the average person doesn't. But before we delve into some of this, let's just talk about some sort of biblical foundations. Mm-hmm. Because what we don't get is we don't get a book of the Bible or an extended passage that says, here's three verses about condoms, and now here's three verses about the birth control pill and different, here's IVF, here's whatever it is. So we don't have that. But what we do have is some trends in the Bible that help us to see what our attitudes are meant to be and what our values are meant to be related to this. For you, we can both share on this, but for you, what do you think are some of the really important biblical foundations or values that need to paint just how we get into this discussion?
Yeah. Well, I think just in the process of preparing for today, you know, getting some time in the Word and studying it revealed new things to me. I think it came back to me upon studying some of this, and the challenges that some of it came upon was Proverbs 3, 5-6, that are trust in the Lord with all your heart and, you know, lean not on your own understanding. Like, that really summed it up for me in a lot of ways, because as we approach the challenges of what the Bible has to say about things and the direction it is, and making this huge decision about children and how to approach our relationship and marriage, we struggle with the control and our plans and releasing it to really follow God. So I think rather than it, like you said, being a legalistic, okay, here's the rules, A, B, C, D, and not A, B, A, you know, and if you follow these rules, you're okay, and if you don't, you don't. I think it's much more like, let us show you what we know about this and then go to the Lord in prayer. You know, I think one of my challenges in this is to really study it for yourself, open it up, look at it, and see what it says, and then pray about it with your spouse or your fiance, or and write it down, write it down, because this is really challenging. Of course, God has something to say about it. It's having kids. It's one of the biggest things in our lives. And so releasing control of it is really hard. But I think if I look through some of the Bible verses and scriptural foundations that really impacted me, one of the most impactful is that first chapter of Luke, where, Elizabeth and Zechariah cannot get pregnant. And so Zechariah becomes a priest. He gets to go into the Holy of Holies. He sees the angel and he says, you're going to have a son. And your prayers have been answered. Mm. So it's like God controls the womb. He's opening Elizabeth's womb now because you prayed, right? You're here. And it talks about John the Baptist then being born, and he's born, I guess he's not yet born. He was like 6 months pregnant. And then the angel comes to Mary and says, you're going to have a baby too. And your cousin is pregnant with John the Baptist, and she goes and visits Elizabeth. So here we have Mary and Elizabeth meeting. And Mary, we think, is about 6 weeks pregnant. So this is about the time when most women find out,
sure,
right? They're first,
real early.
Real early. Yeah. So you miss your period, you do a pregnancy test, it's positive, you're 5-6 weeks pregnant. This is the find out time, about the earliest that you know. And that's where she's at. And she's that early meeting Elizabeth, who's 6 months pregnant with John the Baptist. And Elizabeth exclaims, my baby is doing leaping, it's jumping around inside of me in joy upon meeting you and the baby that's in you. And so we see John the Baptist in utero responding to 6-week in utero Jesus. And the angel even tells him, you know, you're going to be, this baby's going to be filled with the Holy Spirit from its mother's womb. And so when you consider the value of humanity and the eternalness of a human being, it's pretty hard to look at that story and think it's birth, right? It's not human until birth, and anything before then is fine. It becomes, well, if it can be filled with the Holy Spirit and it can respond like that, it must be human being. I think if we approach it from a scientific perspective, it supports that as well, because the full complement of DNA, everything is there at conception. And so scientifically, I think it points to humanity really beginning at conception.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as you talk about the Elizabeth Mary, you know, passage, which is so beautiful, it is a reminder of just the stakes of this conversation. Mm-hmm. That this conversation, because sometimes it does feel kind of separate. And I think even as you talked about Proverbs 3:5-6, there's a lot in our culture of us trying to control things. Mm-hmm. That's not brand new, but I think we have the perception of control and maybe even too much control in some areas where it's just, it gets really strange. And so I think that is part of the subject with this. So the stakes are high. We're talking about life and death. We're talking about babies. We want to be really thoughtful about that. And I think also just even you alluding to the Zachariah, Elizabeth idea, in many ways, that's a parallel to Abraham and Sarah from centuries before, who longed to have a child, thought they were past the age of that, and there was grief over that. Mm-hmm. And I just think about that because you go through the biblical story and, you know, you get to, you know, Jacob and Leah having children and yeah. Rachel just in agony over not being able to have children. And you think of Hannah, Samuel's mother, of just the distress that she was in about not getting to have children. And you could say, all right, in some of these, there probably were identity issues and worth issues where, you know, what's my worth if I don't have a child? And you could say, all right, well, that's an unhealthy way that you find your pride and the idea that you can have children and you find yourself sort of not knowing who you are if you can't. But it's this consistent thread and almost assumption, like, of course you would want to have children. Mm-hmm. You know, you get to Psalm 127 and talking about children being a gift from the Lord and sort of this idea, you know, blessed is a man whose quiver is full. The more, the better is sort of the idea. You know, Ruth being told, or Naomi in the book of Ruth being told that Ruth is better than 7 sons to her, which is like the hugest statement because their idea, having 7 sons, what could be better? Yeah. And so I think that part of this is just looking at our culture right now and saying, even amongst many of us as Christians, there's an easy way for us to go with the cultural flow and see children as, for some of us, see children as like, well, I just don't want any children. Yeah. Like that's just, that seems like a bother. I won't have freedom. I won't be able to do the things that I want to do. And then even for those of us that do have children, to sort of say, well, I want to make sure it's in my timing and that if I have kids, it's the least convenience I can have. And almost talking about life as like, well, there's this golden period before you have kids where you get to do what you want. And then you get them out of the house and then you have the second golden period where you get to go around and play golf and go on cruises because you're no longer taking care of your kids. It's very out of sync with what we get in the biblical idea of just the joy and the blessing of children. So even before we're talking about sort of the ins and outs of how do we understand the science behind birth control, just to say we seem to have a heart issue where for many of us, we go with the cultural trend and we see children as kind of inconvenient, kind of a bother, kind of a barrier to the best life we could be living. And that's something that we really want to fight against.
Yeah. It sneaks into even my own conversations, right? Oh, gosh, we couldn't handle one more. And oh, thank God we're done. You know, those kind of little things kind of slip out. And then you understand that that is kind of in there, you know, your heart of selfishness to keep your life comfortable and organized and make sure you get enough sleep. Yeah, I think when I was looking at it, the biblical foundations were certainly children as a blessing. Psalm 127 came to mind for me too, all the way back to Genesis, right? Genesis 128, 9 verse 1, 9 verse 7, 35 verse 11 is all be fruitful and multiply over and over and over again. And I think that there's a reference in Revelation that talks about, yeah, in the bad times, they will call barren women blessed. Isn't there, you know that verse?
And well, certainly, yeah. And just the whole idea of being barren was like the ultimate bad news you could get. And so thinking of how different that is now, where sometimes you have couples or women sort of celebrating like, I made it. I didn't have any children that messed up my career or my life or my freedom is a real inversion.
Yeah, really is. And probably all the way until not that long ago, right? I mean, my grandma had 10 kids. And that was probably just a real blessing to her. And the idea of having 1.6 children would just be so foreign to even two generations ago. Yeah, I think that's the current average. I did look up that little fact. Yeah. I think Americans are having 1.6 children per couple.
We're below. Yeah. And a lot of kind of, more Western nations are below replacement rate, which we certainly are in the United States. Yeah. And I think, you know, again, that's a symptom because we again, part of the trickiness of this is that, we're looking at this and at least for me, cards on the table, you know, I'm looking at this and saying, okay, I don't think that the sort of the Christian mandate is that you can never have sexual intimacy as a couple unless you're trying to get pregnant. Mm-hmm. I don't think that squares with scripture. I don't think that that's right. I think, you know, we were talking about this beforehand. You have Song of Songs or Song of Solomon, as it's called in different ways. This beautiful, incredible book of the Bible that's about the beauty of sexuality and romantic sexuality, you know, between a man and a woman. Nothing about children in there. Yeah. Like nothing about, well, this is why we're doing this. And so we're not talking. And so we could say, all right, well, we're starting with the idea of saying we're not ruling out that there could be times, whether it was through some kind of contraception or just kind of natural family planning, that you could say, all right, right now we are trying to prevent pregnancy for a season of time. We wouldn't look at that and say, nope, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. We'd say, no, that seems to be within the realm of permissibility, even though we'd want to be careful in saying, even within that, we want to watch our attitude. And if we have a surprise pregnancy come, we want to rejoice. Like I remember, this was years and years ago, but when we were living up in Oregon, I was working with a gal I was a college pastor and she had just come on staff, like literally like weeks before I'd come on staff. And she was probably within her first year of marriage. She was a worship leader. She was just super exuberant, excited about this new position and surprise got pregnant. Mm-hmm. And she was so honest about it that she said, when I first found out, it was definitely not their plan. She said, I cried for a couple days and then I got excited. And so there was this honest recognition of, I had a plan. This wasn't the plan. She allowed herself sort of to grieve that there was going to be a loss or a redirection, but then she embraced this as God's good plan for her. That's the Proverbs 3:5-6, lean not on your own understanding idea there.
Yeah. That's when I looked into it and tried to sort of decipher about sexual intimacy and marriage, you know, certainly marriage being defined man and woman in a covenantal relationship. And we're not diving into too much about that's the place for sexual intimacy and that place alone. And within that context, is it purposeful in other ways besides just reproducing? And I sort of came up with the idea that one of the primary roles of sexual intimacy is to reproduce, but the other part is that it is a gift to be enjoyed. And then even more than that, I think it talks about the mystery of man and woman and the unity. And Paul warns about joining with a prostitute because the two become one flesh. And so I think there is a mystery to sexual relationship that bonds us together in a healing sort of way, in a covenantal sort of way. I always thought, you know, if I were to get in a fight with my sister, I kind of hold on to the grudge for a little bit. But if I have a fight with my wife and then we're together, I'm kind of good right away. And because it has this healing, bonding, maybe kind of erases some of the negatives in each other.
But when I think even, you know, biblically, and I know we're talking a lot before we even get to this, but this is good. When you go all the way back to Eden, that there's that amazing statement in Genesis 2 after the man and the woman come together when it says they were naked and unashamed. Mm. And of course, that's the sort of the warning bell for the fact that in chapter 3, when they sin, they're ashamed of their nakedness. They're hiding from God and they're hiding from each other. You know, they have these inadequate fig leaves that they sew together to make themselves a covering. Mm. Man, there's this vulnerability within sexuality where there's the literally like, well, you're literally naked before someone, but you're as vulnerable as you could be before another person. And the idea that you're received and you're accepted and you're loving each other and you're providing safety for each other, it is, you know, in the best way that the sexual intimacy is almost like this whisper back of Eden, this idea of enjoying something that God made. That certainly, you know, reproduction is a huge part of that. A huge part of the joy of that is that you've come together in this loving relationship and you get to bring children into that. Mm-hmm. And there is just the physical pleasure that's just a joy. But there also is that idea of this is the person that I'm naked and unashamed with. And that there's great beauty in that because it does give us that picture of, well, that's what we were created to be. With one another and with God, that we wouldn't be hiding from each other. And so here's a person that I'm not hiding from, and it's still okay.
Right. Yeah. And when you're first married, you're like all about that, right? you're okay. Let's delay getting pregnant as long as we can to enjoy as much of this as we can. And there's the other side of it too, for sure. Song of Solomon is certainly all about that and celebrating that. And I think we had talked about First Corinthians 7:3-5 and 9. That's Paul's warning to not deny one each other that intimacy, except for a period of fasting. There's almost a command to come together. So I think implied in that is enjoy it. It's a pleasure.
Certainly in that passage, nothing in mind for Paul about reproduction.
Right.
But just in the idea of like, hey, this is your protection from sexual immorality, the idea that we belong to one another. Our bodies are not our own as the husband and wife. They belong to one another. So there is. So here we are, you know, we're in marriage. There's sex is for more than just reproduction, but we are recognizing there's an assumption and then explicit teaching in scripture that children are good, welcome. We want to welcome children. We're living in a culture where that's certainly not to the extent and sometimes is directly opposite. So let's get into a little bit now of just kind of the question of, let's say a couple is thinking through their birth control options. You even alluded to this. You know, Karina and I both saved ourselves sexually for marriage. But when we were engaged, we talked about this because we felt like we need to talk about where we're both at with this. So let's say, you know, there's a couple in that situation, or there's just a married couple that says, you know what, honestly, we've never thought about this. We just did what kind of made sense to us as far as birth control and never gave it another thought. What would be some things that would be worth considering, or maybe just some information that people don't have that should be part of that conversation, that should be part of our grid when we're thinking through questions about birth control?
Yeah. When I give this talk, you know, in clinic and to patients, it's always like, well, here's kind of the options, right? It doesn't always get into this is how they work. And, the morality of it. It's more like just the science and how it works. So let me just run through that real quick. You know, I think when we talk about contraception and basically the purpose of this is to enjoy sexual intimacy without having the natural consequence of having a baby, what can we do? I think it starts probably with just the idea of timed intercourse and the rhythm method, where you're trying to be sexually active during the time when she's not fertile or releasing the egg, what we call ovulation. And then there's the withdrawal method, or you're using a condom during her pregnancy times. Then there's the barrier methods, which I describe as things that are preventing sperm and egg from meeting. And that's things like using a male condom, a female condom, a cervical cap, or a cervical diaphragm. And then even within that barrier methods, there are spermicides that are foams or something that can be inside of a condom that are toxic to the sperm and so are preventing the sperm from even getting up into the female genital tract. So after sort of the rhythm method or timed intercourse barrier methods, then we have all these medicines. And most of these medicines are what I categorize sort of as hormonal. So they're all sort of using estrogen, progesterone, or progesterone derivatives to control ovulation, to thicken the cervical mucus, to make even the uterine lining hostile to implantation. And so when we look at all of these sort of medical hormonal methods, that includes the birth control pill, or what we say is oral contraceptive pills. There's a vaginal ring that you can use. It's placed in for 3 weeks and then you just leave it out 1 week. Same thing, estrogen and progesterone in it. There's an injection called Depo-Provera that you're using once every 3 months. And then there's patches that you can place on the skin. And so each one of these methods is implying a combination of estrogen and progesterone that is feeding back into your brain to reduce the amount of stimulation to the woman's ovaries. And when you change that stimulation, it's preventing her from forming an egg and then releasing that egg in a process of ovulation. So if we don't allow ovulation to occur and the egg is never released, then throughout her cycle, she can enjoy sexual intimacy without getting pregnant. However, we know that these things have a failure rate. So when we talk about the failure rates of some of these, the perfect failure rates, if they're taking perfectly, are claimed to be 1% or even less possibly. But when you look at the real life failure rates, they tend to be between 7, 9, 10%. So we know that pregnancies are still occurring in women that are using these techniques. So somehow it's allowing ovulation sometimes. And so then the idea of, well, are there other ways that the medicine is working? And we think that progesterone in these medicines is thickening a woman's cervical mucus that is sort of working as a barrier method. It's preventing sperm from getting to the egg by thickening that mucus, making it impenetrable. So that's another mechanism. And then the idea that is concerning for us as Christians is, well, does it allow fertilization to occur, but then prevent that new little baby or new fertilized egg from continuing in the pregnancy? Is it getting into the uterus and then being washed through? And there is probably some low level of its mechanism that thins the lining of the uterus and makes it less hospitable for implantation. So I think that's a possibility in all of these methods, that when you consider fertilization, it usually happens in the fallopian tube. And that fertilization process to the uterus is taking about 6 days, 6 to 7, 8 days. And so figure about a week. So you've had fertilization, and now you got a week old baby, fetus, embryo, and it's coming into that uterine cavity, and then it's not implanting. The Catholic Church, for sure, and a lot of Christians actually would say that is promoting a very early abortion. And so that becomes in the Christian community a really big concern. Like, well, wait a minute, can I now use this if that's a possibility? So, you know, in preparing for this, I did look into that and was reading a few studies. And there really is no direct science to give us that answer. We don't get to study women on pills and impregnate them and then see, is it going to implant, and then compare it. We know a lot about early miscarriages could be as high as 40% of all pregnancies. So some surprising statistics that make it like, well, this is a pretty common thing, even if you're not on a birth control pill. And there's the idea that if you got pregnant, you formed the egg, so there was enough hormone there, so the lining should be supported. So that's really not a factor. And there's a lot of controversy surrounding it, which maybe in some ways I'm grateful for, because it allows each person listening today to kind of say, let me take this into consideration. Let me do some of my own research. Let me come to some of my own conclusions about it. And then just bring it to the Lord and trust with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, and just talk it over, take the time, study it, pray about it, and write it down, and then try to walk in obedience as much as you can. It's a very hard issue to release this to God. But I would say, if I was just going to summarize that is likely to be a very minor factor in its mechanism. I don't want to give you an exact number, like it's 1% of how it works. But it's likely to be very low. Certainly less than 10% of its mechanism is preventing implantation. And I think it's likely to be much, much lower than that. But nobody really knows for sure.
Yeah. Now, just as kind of a follow-up on that, you know, so you kind of sketched for us out, you know, the different contraception methods, the different implications of them. Within that, are there some, whether it's forms of oral contraception, like forms of things that would be to a different level of intent? Because you're talking about just kind of like the more stereotypical, like I'm on the pill, I'm on the birth control pill. The intent of that is not to have a baby aborted.
Right.
But we're talking about the idea of, all right, for us as believers, it should be taken into consideration that this is something that, because of the mechanism of this, that is a risk. Are there other forms of that would fit into the category of oral contraception that it is actually much more the intent and the function of them that they would cause an abortion? Morning after pill, things, you know, things of that nature.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think until you maybe move on to sort of the next category, which is the devices, you know, and an intrauterine device, either a Mirena or Skyla, Kylena, or even a copper IUD. These have been around since Egyptian times, I think, right? These insertable type devices. I think that the likelihood that an intrauterine device is actively preventing implantation is much more higher component of how that works, rather than birth control pills and patches and rings and shots. But in terms of hormonal, like for a lot of women, I think even for me as a prescriber, it's quite common to use hormonal contraceptives for just a huge variety of medical conditions, endometriosis and polycystic ovarian syndrome and irregular bleeding. And it has probably for a lot of women, a lot of big health benefits, even reduction of possibly some different types of cancer, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, probably reduced by the use of these. And, when you look at the different choices, are there ones that are less likely to prevent implantation? I don't really think so. I think they're probably all to some very low level possibly doing that.
Yeah.
If I then go on to, you know, medicines and all the hormonal methods, the devices, we also have this implant, which is a 3-year implant in the arm called a Nexplanon. And the Nexplanon is similar to the other hormonal methods because although it's an insert, it's in the arm, it's releasing a level of progesterone, etonorgestrel type of progesterone or even androgen that's actively trying to inhibit ovulation, similar to the other medical ones. And then after that, you have sterilization, you know, vasectomies and fallopian tube ligations or the tubal ligation or even having your tubes removed in a way. I think that's the way it sort of is categorized when you see your doctor, you know, okay, there's barrier methods, here's a bunch of medicines, you can have an implant and here's sterilization. And it's often approached from the idea of what's more convenient for me and then what are the failure rates? And when we look at failure rates, of course, these rhythm methods and barrier methods have failure rates of 15% or 20%. And so they're often sort of shunned in a way by the medical community. Well, you don't want to use that because those failure rates are unacceptably high. And so we really want to make sure we never get pregnant because we're in school or we're not married or we're having a financial time. So we really got to make sure we don't get pregnant. You want to move up to something that's going to be way more effective at preventing pregnancy. And that's when you get into the devices. And so there's sort of like this push in the medical community to sort of encourage women to use IUDs and to use in the Nexplanon because their failure rates are less than 1%. So yeah, you go from 15 to 20% failure rate with barrier methods and rhythm method to most hormonal contraceptives having failure rates between 2 and 9% to implants that are having failure rates of less than 1%. And then finally, this sterilization, this permanent, never, ever going to get pregnant again decision. You know, I think for me, a lot of times when you start studying sort of the implications of contraception, it kind of, it feels like it pushes you back into the idea of, should I even use contraception? You know, when you start discovering this, you start having some of those feelings like, well, none of it sounds great. You know, like how do I then approach this?
Yeah, it does. There are times where it almost feels like we're part of a sci-fi movie, you know, yeah. Where you watch, you know, I mean, you know, this is back from the 90s, but a few weeks ago, Karina and I were rewatching that movie Gattaca, which if you've ever seen, it's one of the themes of the story is sort of about genetic engineering and people are basically going in and choosing what they want their kid to look like. And that there's some different elements like that to it that feel, I remember, you know, in the mid 90s felt like, oh, that's scary. And now it's like, we're not quite there. But when we're talking about these sorts of things, I think for me, one of the things that comes up just in my heart is, gosh, is this a level of control that we're meant to have beyond just the sort of the ethical questions? And again, even when you're talking about, you know, women's bodies are complicated. There's all kinds of things happening. And adding the hormones to that, thinking even beyond the ethical issues, like, all right, what is the toll like that on a woman's body? You know, that there's benefits, but there can also be sort of challenges that come with that. But I think it does re-enter into the heart issue and say, all right, what is our goal with this whole thing? Is our goal to look to create a family that reflects God's values and reflects the idea of, you know, God welcoming us as his children, God taking joy in people having children, you know, going all the way back to Genesis 1, to be fruitful and multiply, the idea that children are seen as a blessing and that raising children, is this great, amazing thing that we're a part of. The idea that in the New Testament, there certainly is a place given to the Christian that chooses to stay single because they're calling from God. They say, I think it's better for me not to take on the responsibility of a wife and children or a husband and children. There's nothing that points towards the idea of like a married couple saying, we're not going to have children. It doesn't mean it's impossible, but there's nothing in the Bible that would command like, hey, here's a choice that should be on the table, get married and don't have children. Mm. So we get into sort of all of those themes and we start to ask the question like, all right, is this stuff allowed? And we may come to the conclusion on a good chunk of it to say, yeah. We think it's allowed. But how are we being guided by a bigger goal than simply not getting pregnant or only being pregnant at the exact time of our choosing.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, I'm grateful you had the courage to say through something at church, let's talk about it, because I don't think a lot of people do. And I think it's important. But I would say releasing the control of getting pregnant to the Lord is also one of those biblical foundations. And what I discovered on studying it is the idea that the womb is the Lord's. And I just want to point to a couple of verses that really explain that crazy well. One of them is in Genesis 20, 17 through 18. This is the story of Abraham and Sarah. And they come into the kingdom of Abimelech, I think it is. And he finds Sarah super attractive, and so he brings Sarah in, and Abraham is saying, this is my sister. And so he doesn't know that they're married because Abraham's afraid to tell him. And then the Lord closes all the wombs of the whole kingdom. And then Abimelech comes and says, you lied to me. Sarah is your wife. And he's like, yeah, okay, yeah, she's my wife. And then Abraham prays for them. And because of Abraham's prayer, God then reopens all the wombs of Abimelech's people. So it's this crazy, like, not just one person, but the whole kingdom.
The whole nation.
The whole nation. Nobody's getting pregnant because God just says, yep, not nobody's getting pregnant. And then Abraham prays, and then all of them are getting pregnant again. They're all suddenly fertile again. And I want to be careful with this because I know there's probably people who are infertile, right? 15% of all women and couples. And so this would be really hard to kind of understand, like, God is in control of fertility, and why is this not happening for me? And that's just so hard. And my heart kind of goes out for that. It's probably a whole other talk.
It is. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, anytime we're talking about this, there is that side of it, which you find a lot of, if you're dealing with that as a couple, you find so much in scripture about the struggle of infertility, you know, in talking about, you know, I mean, the patriarchs, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebecca, Jacob and Rachel for a long time. Yeah. You get, you know, Elkanah and Hannah, Zacharias and Elizabeth. You have these constant themes of that does give a sense of maybe being seen when you're in it. But you're right, there could be a whole other just topic about the question, what do you do when you're longing to have children and God's in control of the womb and you're not sure what he's up to?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I discovered all of those stories about infertility, and it's very specific. It always says that the Lord then opened her womb. It's not like, yeah, okay, then she got pregnant. It's specifically saying that God did it. You know, I think of when you really did it, you know, sort of think about it on your own, you're thinking, well, we have a role, we have a play. God likes to involve us.
Well, for sure. Yeah. I think it fits nicely into the overall mystery that we all live in, with God having a sovereign plan, but us having responsible actions, and that we don't just say, you know, because we don't just conclude on this subject, well, God opens and closes the womb. So even if I've had a vasectomy and she's had her tubes tied, God could still do, you know, that would be a weird approach, because we don't, you know, we don't just sit around and say, well, God is the one who provides, so I'll just sit in my house. And if he gives me money, he gives me money. We have that balance of God is sovereign, we have responsibility, and that carries over into talking about contraception and birth control and childbearing and all of those things.
Sure. Yeah, and I think it gets back to the heart. It gets back to, you know, examine your own heart, pray about it, get together, maybe a trusted group in your small group, in your home group, in your life group and saying, hey, can we talk about this a little bit and struggle through that decision? And for me, I always had to kind of write it down because later it'd be like, did God really say, you know, but just understanding, you know, biblically, there is this huge component of God being in control of it. And just consider it. You know, I think there's lots of health reasons that could explain why somebody would use birth control pills or a contraception. Heck, I think it's almost 65, 70% of all women have at some time used the birth control pill. You know, certainly when you consider some of the dramatic health benefits that come for women, I think it just excludes the idea that we could ever come to this hard stop of saying it can never be there. So I do want to take a time in this talk, if there's anybody listening saying, well, nobody should ever use birth control pills. I want to just say, hey, just be aware there's some pretty dramatic health indications, medical indications, disease indications that this is one of the only real ways besides maybe a very complicated surgery to really help women. And, you know, I'm reminded of the woman who was bleeding foot for 12 years and touched Jesus' cloak and got how big of a deal that was. And I think something like a birth control pill can probably provide that for some patients. So that's, it's complicated in that regard.
Well, let me even follow up because this might be a good direction for us to go in just talking for a little bit. So let's say, you know, we're going into this maybe, and probably with somewhat a well-founded assumption that our cultural norm is more in the direction of not having kids, preventing the birth of kids, having fewer kids, abortion. So we're looking at that and saying, for a lot of people listening, there's probably been too much pull on that side. Let's just say right now there's somebody listening and they feel very, you know, like moved and convicted by this. And now they are feeling like, well, gosh, is it ever okay to try, like, would there ever be a permissible reason to try to prevent me from having as many children as I possibly could have over the course of the time that I'm at a childbearing stage of life? What might be, and again, like we're not in a position here where we're trying to talk principles. We're not right here trying to talk people out of having children, but what might be things to consider for somebody that maybe is just saying, well, I'm going to just have as many kids as I can and no birth control ever, not even natural family planning, you know, the rhythm method that you said, none of that. We're just going to, you know, and nobody should ever do anything. Are there any mitigating circumstances that you might say, well, consider this might be a reason for somebody for a season to do this?
Sure. Well, I guess it just sort of gets personal. You know, Jody and I have four kids and we lost one at about eight and a half weeks. And I think that experience for me helped me look into this a little bit too at that time and understand what was happening and going through that loss. I would say we're working in a sinful, broken world. And what does the world look like if all of us are using no contraception at all, get married young and just having as many babies as possible, you know? I think the idea of something being a blessing, according to scripture, is not necessarily the same thing as saying, therefore, go and get as much of that blessing as you possibly can. You know, I like ice cream. Ice cream's, I think, a blessing from the Lord. But if I tried to get as much of it as I could, I would end up being unhealthy. And it's not quite the same. But at the same point, I don't think it's a mandate to try to get as much of it as you can. And because I think the conclusion through study that I've reached is I think there are multiple purposes of sexual intimacy besides having kids. It's okay to then pursue the other components of it without always seeking for the blessing. But the complexity of a sinful world in our culture, especially in Southern California, certainly it would be very financially challenging to have 10 kids. And certainly there would be the challenges of being a parent present in their life and available to them to nurture and disciple them and to bring them up in the Lord. And especially alone. I mean, if you think about the community that used to be present, probably in families where there was 10 kids and grandpa and grandma lived with them and everybody was so supportive and all women knew the burden of, oh yeah, we need to go around and help this lady. She's got a lot of kids. We're so independent and we're so kind of isolated. People don't even live near their parents anymore. And it, I think it gets very challenging to say, okay, we're not going to use anything and possibly have 10, 12, 15 kids because we never use anything. The idea of overpopulation, probably when I was young, I don't know if that is still out there in culture, but it was like the idea of being so irresponsible, you know, for the environment. You're over, the world's overpopulated. You're having way too many children. I think that's a terrible lie.
Okay, good. I was about to say, oh, we're going to have a disagreement.
No.
I don't think that should factor in at all.
I think,
but I do think what you've brought up here, this is part of why I wanted to go down this road a little bit to say, there are some cultural pulls that we need to push back against.
Yeah.
But there also are some recognitions of saying, okay, what sort of a cultural situation are we living in? And then even sort of what are we looking at with each specific family? Where sometimes there's couples that have wanted to have multiple kids and pregnancy and childbirth has been so brutally hard on the wife, the mom, has just, you know, deep danger really just took a lot out of her to the point that I think it's okay for that to be a factor in the decision making to say, we're concerned about her health going on. And we know if she got pregnant, we wouldn't be having an abortion. So we're thinking through now, like, am I putting my wife in not sort of a vulnerable position that every pregnant woman is in, but especially vulnerable because, man, I don't know if her body can handle this again. And then as you said, you know, when you're living in a culture that's much more communal and sort of much more tribal, there's good and bad things about that. But where it's like, if you have a kid, everybody sort of in the family clan is like, well, we're all sharing responsibility for this kid versus our culture now. We could say, all right, we don't want that to be an excuse to just go with the flow of the culture. But it is worth considering of saying, all right, there's a little bit of a different burden that's borne both financially and just as far as responsibility for the mom and dad in many of the cases that we're in. You know, I mean, as you said, like for a good chunk of our child raising years, we had literally no extended family within 1,000 miles of us. And so, you know, that's not a reason not to have kids or not to push back against the cultural norms. For me, and then this is a harder thing. This is where as Christians, we live in that we're not being legalistic, but we're also not just doing whatever feels good in the moment. Where I say, I think it's great within the Christian community if what we're doing with regard to children is countercultural. And it's weird because even for, you know, you have four kids. We have three kids. For us, even with three kids, we get some sort of like sideways glances. You guys certainly with four kids do. This is small potatoes compared to a lot of cultures in the past with how many kids they have. But I think that there's something positive about people saying like, those Christians are having a lot of kids, like a lot more than others. I think that that alone is an act of sort of positive cultural defiance. And so while we could always say like, we could have tried to have more kids. You could have tried to have more kids. We, like, none of us maxed out and said, well, you know, God just clearly shut the door on this. But I think there is something positive just towards inching toward the idea of saying we want to have more than's normal in general. But we also, we want to consider mom's health here. We do want to consider if we're bearing more responsibility than more parents have through most of time. It's okay for those factors to work in to an overall heart saying, God, we want to be open to whatever you have for us. And we want our home to be a home that welcomes and celebrates children.
Yeah. Well, certainly, I mean, for a lot of women listening to this, you may even be older and the doctor's calling you advanced maternal age or an elderly multigravid just because you're over age 35 and you're like, oh gosh, you know, I shouldn't have any more kids. I'm getting so old. And there is some truth to that. Miscarriages are much higher as you get older, and having high blood pressure and diabetes and even having a stroke or a blood clot in pregnancy become a factor. Certainly there's women who have C-sections, and having that multitude of 3, 4, 5 C-sections can start to put even mom's life at risk. Certainly there are women who are battling lupus and high blood pressure issues and are on medicines that possibly are contraindicated in pregnancy, breast cancer, fighting cancer, had cancer. I think there's just a multitude of things to be aware of and sensitive to, whenever you're feeling the temptation to judge about, hey, there's a lot of reasons I think that women would be, in my opinion, justified in using these types of things. As far as though, the idea of, well, where do we go with it? I would say, you know, James, this is one of the things I thought about when I was studying for it, is James says, whoever asks for wisdom in chapter one there, that God gives abundantly. And when you don't have faith that he's going to give you that answer, you're like a wave tossed in a ocean. And I think I did feel that, like, with a lot of decisions where you're feeling your heart being pulled, James got it right, because you are feeling tossed around as you aren't totally relying on the wisdom you're getting. There's a little bit of pushback. Well, I think he's saying that, but no. And I think we just really want to encourage a couple of things. Like, one is, for young people, really open up your heart to the idea of having children. It is a remarkable thing with your walk with God to have kids. It is such a powerful picture of salvation. It is such a powerful picture of love. It is so revealing to your own heart and your own maturing and walk with the Lord. And I want to be sensitive here to people that don't have children, like somehow you're inferior or something. I don't want to say that at all. I think you have to walk in what God has for you. And that's always the best. But if he's given you fertility and your option is there and you're married and you're young, really open your heart up to having a large family. I think it's fantastic. I highly recommend it. I think there's just an abundance of blessing there. Psalm 127 tells us that there is. And when you're asking for wisdom about difficult decisions, maybe you're listening and you have a medical condition, or you are getting older, or you're strapped financially, and you're like, man, I've been on this birth control pill for years. Should I stop? You know, James tells us, you pray and you ask for that wisdom, and he just gives it generously. Yeah. And I don't know how to explain it, but maybe that there would be a peace, like instead of being tossed around on that wave as you just navigate, what about my health? What about the idea that it's an abortifacient? What about this? And you're just being tossed around with all these thoughts. You can just finally rest on hearing from the Lord. You get together with your partner, your spouse, and you're saying, hey, honey, what do we do here? And you pray together and you write down your conclusions and you look back on those and you say, this is where we have peace. And I think that is the place we want to encourage everybody to be in.
No, I love that. And I mean, I think that lands us in the right place. And just putting in there, back to the whole purpose of why we're doing this episode. For many ways, the reason why we're doing this episode is because we say, we think this should be a conversation. Mm-hmm. We think engaged couples and couples, married couples who are still in the childbearing phase, we think this should be part of the conversation. We think that it shouldn't just be like, oh, of course I'm going to go on the pill. That's what everyone does. We think, like, you might land there.
Yeah.
Make it part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Well, of course, you know, 2 kids and no more because we can't handle it. That might be where the Lord lands you. Have the conversation. There's so much beauty in this, and we get surprised by how God leads us. And what we don't want to do is we don't want to rob God of an opportunity to show him providing and enabling us to do something that we didn't think that we could do. And I think that that too often happens in this. And so a big part, just as we kind of speak directly to those of you listening right now, is to encourage you, have these conversations. If you're a parent with kids, have these conversations with your kids. Make this a part of the factor. It's okay. God is going to lead us in different ways in how we handle this. But in the same way that we wouldn't say, watch whatever you want and never think about it, engage with this thoughtfully, prayerfully, not taking it for granted, and being open to how God may lead you. Mm. And Corey, I just want to thank you for coming on.
Yep.
Tricky topic, but yeah, you're a gift to our church in many ways. And I know that you're a gift to Assure Pregnancy Clinic as you look to advocate for the unborn and care for pregnant ladies. And their families.
Yeah.
And thank you so much, those of you who took the time to listen to this. We put out content on the Christian Contrast because we want people to be able to delve into tricky and difficult and sometimes controversial subjects and say, how does God lead me to live in a way that's different than the cultural norm? And so that's our hope in this episode. We put episodes of the Christian Contrast out every 2 weeks. And so the good news is, if you liked this and you found this helpful, you can go onto our YouTube page for Life Bible Fellowship Church, or you can go to our website for lbf.church, and you can find all kinds of episodes that we've done in the past that delve into other topics where we're looking to be guided by Christ, by the gospel, and by God's word. And so we'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Until then, thanks so much for taking the time to listen.